Spectacle for Leibowitz by Walter M. Miller, Jr. Continued. Cassette 4, Side 1. The monk fumbled in one sleeve. It seemed weighted down with half a bushel of documents and correspondence, but after a moment he found the right one. Affixed to the scroll was the label, Sub immunitate apostolica hoc suppositum est, quisquis nuncium molestare audeat, ipso facto excommunicetur. Detail, Redissimo Domno Paolo de Pecos, Albertian Order of Leibowitz, Abati, Monastery of the Leibowitzian Brethren, Environs of Sanley Bowitz Village, Southwest Desert, Empire of Denver. Qui salutem dicit, Marcus Apollo, Papatiae Apocrisarius Texarchanae. All right, that's the one, so read it, the abbot said impatiently. Ac cedite ad eum. The monk crossed himself and murmured the customary blessing of texts, said before reading or writing almost as punctiliously as the blessing at meals. For the preservation of literacy and learning throughout a black millennium had been the task of the Brothers of Leibowitz, and such small rituals helped keep that task in focus. Having finished the blessing, he held the scroll high against the sunset so that it became a transparency. Iterum oportet apponere tibi crucem ferendam, amice. His voice was faintly sing-song, as his eyes plucked the words out of a forest of superfluous pen-flourishings. The abbot leaned against the parapet to listen, while he watched the buzzards circling over the mesa of last resort. Again it is necessary to set before you a cross to be borne, old friend and shepherd of myopic bookworms, droned the voice of the reader. But perhaps the bearing of the cross will smack of triumph. It appears that Sheba is coming to Solomon after all, though probably to denounce him as a charlatan. This is to notify you that Thon Taddeo Fardentrot, D.N.S.C., Sage of Sages, Scholar of Scholars, fair-haired son out of wedlock of a certain prince, and God's gift to an awakening generation, has finally made up his mind to pay you a visit, having exhausted all hope of transporting your memorabilia to this far realm. He will be arriving about the Feast of the Assumption, if he manages to evade bandit groups along the way. He will bring his misgivings and a small party of armed cavalry, courtesy of Hannigan II, whose corpulent person is even now hovering over me as I write, grunting and scowling at these lines, which his supremacy commanded me to write, and in which his supremacy expects me to acclaim his cousin, the Thon, in the hope that you will honor him fittingly. But since his supremacy's secretary is in bed with the gout, I shall be no less than candid here. So first let me caution you about this person, Thon Taddeo. Treat him with your customary charity, but trust him not. He is a brilliant scholar, but a secular scholar and a political captive of the state. Here, Hannigan is the state. Furthermore, the Thon is rather anti-clerical, I think, or perhaps solely anti-monastic. After his embarrassing birth, he was spirited away to a Benedictine monastery, and... But no, ask the courier about that. The monk glanced up from his reading. The abbot was still watching the buzzards over last resort.
"You've heard about his childhood, brother?"
Dom Paolo asked. The monk nodded.
"Read on."
The reading continued, but the abbot ceased to listen. He knew the letter nearly by heart, but still he felt that there was something Marcus Apollo had been trying to say between the lines that he, Dom Paolo, had not yet managed to understand. Marcus was trying to warn him, but of what? The tone of the letter was mildly flippant, but it seemed full of ominous incongruities, which might have been designed to add up to some single dark congruity, if only he could add them right. What danger could there be in letting the secular scholar study at the abbey? Thon Taddeo himself, according to the courier who had brought the letter, had been educated in the Benedictine monastery where he had been taken as a child to avoid embarrassment to his father's wife. The Thon's father was Hannigan's uncle, but his mother was a serving maid. The Duchess, legitimate wife of the Duke, had never protested the Duke's philandering until this common servant girl bore him the son he had always wanted. Then she cried, unfair. She had borne him only daughters, and to be bested by a commoner aroused her wrath. She sent the child away, flogged and dismissed the servant, and renewed her grip on the Duke. She herself meant to have a man-child out of him to re-establish her honor. She gave him 3 more girls. The Duke waited patiently for 15 years. When she died in miscarriage of another girl, he promptly went to the Benedictines to reclaim the boy and make him his heir. But the young Taddeo of Hannigan Fardentrot had become a bitter child. He had grown from infancy to adolescence within sight of the city and the palace where his first cousin was being prepared for the throne. If his family had entirely ignored him, however, he might have matured without coming to resent his status as an outcast. But both his father and the servant girl whose womb had borne him came to visit him with just enough frequency to keep him reminded that he was begotten of human flesh, and not of stones, and thus to make him vaguely aware that he was deprived of love to which he was entitled. And then, too, Prince Hannigan had come to the same monastery for 1 year of schooling, had lorded it over his bastard cousin, and had excelled him in all things but keenness of mind. The young Taddeo had hated the prince with a quiet fury, and had set out to outdistance him as far as possible, in learning at least. The race had proved a sham, however. The prince left the monastic school the following year, as unlettered as he had come, nor was any further thought given to his education. Meanwhile, his exiled cousin continued the race alone, and won high honors. But his victory was hollow, for Hannigan did not care. Thon Taddeo had come to despise the whole court of Texarkana, but, with youthful inconsistency, he had returned willingly to that court to be legitimized as the father's son at last, appearing to forgive everyone except the dead duchess who had exiled him, and the monks who had cared for him in that exile.
"Perhaps he thinks of our cloister as a place of durance vile," thought the abbot. "There would be bitter memories, half-memories, and maybe a few imagined memories."
Seeds of controversy in the bed of the new literacy, the reader continued. So take heed and watch for the symptoms. But on the other hand, not only his supremacy, but the dictates of charity and justice as well, insist that I recommend him to you as a well-meaning man, or at least as an unmalicious child, like most of these educated and gentlemanly pagans, and pagans they will make of themselves, in spite of all. He will behave if you are firm, but be careful, my friend. He has a mind like a loaded musket, and it can go off in any direction. I trust, however, that coping with him for a while will not be too taxing a problem for your ingenuity and hospitality. Quidam mihi calix nuper expletur, Paule. Precomini ergo deum facere me fortiorem. Metuo utique periat. Spero te et fratres sapius oraturos esse pro tremescente Marco Apolline. Valete in Christo, amici. Texarcane datum est octava sancti patriot Pauli, anno domini termilesimo.
Let's see that seal again, said the abbot.
The monk handed him the scroll. Don Paolo held it close to his face to peer at blurred lettering, impressed at the bottom of the parchment by a badly inked wooden stamp. Okayed by Hannigan II, by grace of God, mayor, ruler of Texarkana, defender of the faith, and vaquero supreme of the plains. His mark, X.
I wonder if his supremacy had someone read the letter to him later, worried the abbot. If so, my lord, would the letter have been sent? I suppose not, but frivolity under Hannigan's nose, just to spite the mayor's illiteracy, is not like Marcus Apollo, unless he was trying to tell me something between the lines, but couldn't quite think of a safe way to say it. That last part, about a certain chalice that he's afraid won't pass away. It's clear he's worried about something, but what? It isn't like Marcus, it isn't like him at all.
Several weeks had passed since the arrival of the letter. During those weeks Don Paolo had slept badly, had suffered a recurrence of the old gastric trouble, had brooded overmuch on the past, as if looking for something that might have been done differently in order to avert the future. What future, he demanded of himself. There seemed no logical reason to expect trouble. The controversy between monks and villagers had all but died. No signs of turmoil came from the herdsmen tribes to the north and east. Imperial Denver was not pressing its attempt to levy taxes upon monastic congregations. There were no troops in the vicinity. The oasis was still furnishing water. There seemed no current threat of plague among animals or men. The corn was doing well this year in the irrigated fields. There were no signs of progress in the world, and the village of Sanli Bowitz had achieved the fantastic literacy rate of 8%, for which the villagers might, but did not, thank the monks of the Leibowitzian order. And yet he felt forebodings. Some nameless threat lurked just around the corner of the world for the sun to rise again. The feeling had been gnawing at him, as annoying as a swarm of hungry insects that buzzed about one's face in the desert sun. There was the sense of the imminent, the remorseless, the mindless. It coiled like a heat-maddened rattler, ready to strike at rolling tumbleweed. It was a devil with which he was trying to come to grips, the abbot decided, but the devil was quite evasive. The abbot's devil was rather small, as devils go, only knee-high, but he weighed 10 tons, and had the strength of 500 oxen. He was not driven by maliciousness, as Dom Paolo imagined him, not nearly as much as he was driven by frenzied compulsion, somewhat after the fashion of a rabid dog. He bit through meat and bone and nail, simply because he had damned himself, and damnation created a damnably insatiable appetite. And he was evil merely because he had made a denial of good, and the denial had become a part of his essence, or a hole therein. Somewhere, Dom Paolo thought, he's wading through a sea of men and leaving a wake of the maimed.
"What nonsense, old man," he chided himself. "When you tire of living, change itself seems evil, does it not? For then any change at all disturbs the death-like peace of the life-weary. Oh, there's the devil all right, but let's not credit him with more than his damnable due. Are you that life-weary, old fossil?"
But the foreboding lingered.
"Do you suppose the buzzards have eaten old Eleazar yet?"
asked a quiet voice at his elbow. Dom Paolo glanced around with a start in the twilight. The voice belonged to Father Galt, his prior and probable successor. He stood fingering a rose, and looking embarrassed for having disturbed the old man's solitude.
"Eleazar? You mean Benjamin? Why, have you heard something about him lately?"
"Well, no, Father Abbot." He laughed uneasily. "But you seem to be looking toward the mesa, and I thought you were wondering about the old Jew." He glanced toward the anvil-shaped mountain, silhouetted against the gray patch of sky in the west.
"There's a wisp of smoke up there, so I guess he's still alive." "We shouldn't have to guess," Dom Paolo said abruptly. "I'm going to ride over there and pay him a visit."
"You sound like you're leaving tonight," Galt chuckled.
"In a day or two."
"Better be careful. They say he throws rocks at climbers."
"I haven't seen him for 5 years," the abbot confessed, "and I'm ashamed that I haven't. He's lonely. I'll go."
"If he's lonely, why does he insist on living like a hermit?"
"To escape loneliness in a young world?"
The young priest laughed. "That perhaps makes his kind of sense, Domne, but I don't quite see it."
"You will, when you're my age, or his."
"I don't expect to get that old. He lays claim to several 1,000 years. The abbot smiled reminiscently.
"And you know, I can't dispute him either. I met him when I was just a novice 50-odd years ago, and I'd swear he looked just as old then as he does now. He must be well over 100.
3,209, so he says, sometimes even older. I think he believes it, too. An interesting madness."
"I'm not so sure he's mad, Father. Just devious in his sanity. What did you want to see me about?"
Three small matters. First, how do we get the poet out of the royal guest rooms before Than Taddeo arrives? He's due here in a few days, and the poet's taken root."
"I'll handle the poet, sirrah. What else?"
"Vespers. Will you be in the church?"
"Not until Comblin. You take over. What else?"
Controversy in the basement over Brother Kornhauer's experiment."
"Who and how?"
"Well, the silly gist of it seems to be that Brother Armbruster has the attitude of Vespero Mundi Expectando, while with Brother Kornhauer, it's the matins of the millennium. Kornhauer moves something to make room for a piece of equipment. Armbruster yells, 'Perdition!' Brother Kornhauer yells, 'Progress!' and they have at each other again. Then they come fuming to me to settle it. I scold them for losing their tempers. They get sheepish and fawn on each other for 10 minutes. 6 hours later, the floor shivers from Brother Armbruster's bellowing, 'Perdition!' down in the library. I can settle the blow-ups, but there seems to be a basic issue.
A basic breach of conduct, I'd say. What do you want me to do about it? Exclude them from the table?
Not yet, but you might warn them.
All right, I'll track it down. Is that all?
That's all, Domne. He started away, but paused.
Oh, by the way, do you think Brother Kornhoer's contraption is going to work?
I hope not, the abbot snorted. Father Galt appeared surprised.
But then why let him?
Because I was curious at first. The work has caused so much commotion by now, though, that I'm sorry I let him start it.
Then why not stop him?
Because I'm hoping that he will reduce himself to absurdity without any help from me. If the thing fails, it'll fail just in time for Thantadio's arrival. That would be just the proper form of mortification for Brother Kornhoer, to remind him of his vocation, before he begins thinking that he was called to religion mainly for the purpose of building a generator of electrical essences in the monastery basement.
But, Father Abbot, you'll have to admit that it would be quite an achievement, if successful.
I don't have to admit it, Dom Paolo told him curtly. When Galt was gone, the abbot, after a brief debate with himself, decided to handle the problem of the poet Seurat before the problem of the perdition versus progress. The simplest solution to the problem of the poet was for the poet to get out of the royal suite, and preferably out of the abbey, out of the vicinity of the abbey, out of sight, hearing, and mind. But no one could expect a simplest solution to get rid of the poet Seurat. The abbot left the wall and crossed the courtyard toward the guest house. He moved by feel, for the buildings were monoliths of shadow under the stars, and only a few windows glowed with candlelight. The windows of the royal suite were dark, but the poet kept odd hours and might well be in. Inside the building he groped for the right door, found it, and knocked. There was no immediate answer, but only a faint bleeding sound, which might or might not have issued from within the suite. He knocked again, then tried the door. It opened. Faint red light from a charcoal burner softened the darkness. The room reeked of stale food.
Poet?
Again the faint bleeding, but closer now. He went to the burner, raked up an incandescent coal, and lit a splinter of kindling. He glanced around and shuddered at the litter of the room. It was empty. He transferred the flame to an oil lamp and went to explore the rest of the suite. It would have to be thoroughly scrubbed and fumigated, also perhaps exorcised, before Thantadio moved in. He hoped to make the poet Seurat do the scrubbing, but knew the chance was remote. In the second room, Dom Paolo suddenly felt as if someone were watching him. He paused and looked slowly around. A single eyeball peered at him from a vase of water on the shelf. The abbot nodded at it familiarly and went on. In the third room, he met the goat. It was their first meeting. The goat was standing atop a tall cabinet, munching turnip greens. It looked like a small breed of mountain goat, but it had a bald head that appeared bright blue by lamplight, undoubtedly a freak by birth.
Poet,
he inquired softly, looking straight at the goat and touching his pectoral cross.
In here,
came a sleepy voice from the fourth room. Dom Paolo sighed with relief. The goat went on munching greens. Now that had been a hideous thought, indeed. The poet lay sprawled across the bed with a bottle of wine within easy reach. He blinked irritably at the light with his one good eye.
I was asleep,
he complained, adjusting his black eye patch and reaching for the bottle.
Then wake up. You're moving out of here immediately, tonight. Dump your possessions in the hall to let the suite air out. Sleep in the stable boy's cell downstairs, if you must. Then come back in the morning and scrub this place out.
The poet looked like a bruised lily for a moment, then made a grab for something under the blankets. He brought out a fist and stared at it thoughtfully.
"Who used these quarters last?"
he asked.
"Monsignor Longhi, why?"
"I wondered who brought the bedbugs." The poet opened his fist, pinched something out of his palm, cracked it between his nails, and flipped it away.
"Thantadio can have them. I don't want them. I've been eaten up alive ever since I moved in. I was planning on leaving, but now that you've offered me my old cell back, I'll be happy.
I didn't mean
to accept your kind hospitality a little longer. Only until my book is finished, of course.
What book? But never mind. Just get your things out of here.
Now?
Now.
Good. I don't think I could stand these bugs another night.
The poet rolled out of the bed, but paused for a drink.
Give me the wine, the abbot ordered. Sure, have some. It's a pleasant vintage. Thank you, since you stole it from our cellars. It happens to be sacramental wine. Did that occur to you?
It hasn't been consecrated.
I'm surprised you thought of that.
Don Paolo took the bottle. I didn't steal it anyway.
Never mind the wine. Where did you steal the goat?
I didn't steal it, the poet complained.
It just materialized?
It was a gift, Reverendissime.
From whom?
A dear friend, Domnissime.
Whose dear friend?
Mine, sire.
Now there's a paradox. Where, now, did you...
Benjamin, sire.
A flicker of surprise crossed Don Paolo's face. You stole it from old Benjamin?
The poet winced at the word. Please, not stole.
Then what?
Benjamin insisted that I take it as a gift after I had composed a sonnet in his honor.
The truth.
The poet Seurat swallowed sheepishly. I won it from him at Mumbly Peg.
I see.
It's true. The old wretch nearly cleaned me out, and then refused to allow me credit. I had to stake my glass eye against the goat, but I want everything back.
Get the goat out of the abbey.
But it's a marvelous species of goat. The milk is of an unearthly odor and contains essences. In fact, it's responsible for the old Jew's longevity.
How much of it?
All 5,408 years of it.
I thought he was only 3,200 and...
Don Paolo broke off disdainfully.
What were you doing up on Last Resort?
Playing Mumbly Peg with old Benjamin.
I mean...
The abbot steeled himself.
Never mind, just get yourself moved out, and tomorrow get the goat back to Benjamin.
But I want it fairly.
We'll not discuss it. Take the goat to the stable, then. I'll have it returned to him myself.
Why?
We have no use for a goat, neither have you.
Ho, ho, the poet said archly.
What did that mean, pray?
Fontario is coming. He'll be in need of a goat before it's finished. You can be sure of that.
He chuckled smugly to himself. The abbot turned away in irritation. Just get out, he added superfluously, and then went to wrestle with contention in the basement, where the memorabilia now reposed.
Chapter 14. The vaulted basement had been dug during the centuries of nomadic infiltration from the north, when the Bering horde had overrun most of the plains and desert, looting and vandalizing all villages that lay in their path. The memorabilia, the abbey's small patrimony of knowledge out of the past, had been walled up in underground vaults to protect the priceless writings from both nomads and soi-disant crusaders of the schismatic orders, founded to fight the hordes, but turned to random pillaging and sectarian strife. Neither the nomads nor the military order of San Pancrats would have valued the abbey's books, but the nomads would have destroyed them for the joy of destruction, and the military knights friars would have burned many of them as heretical, according to the theology of Viserion, their antipope. Now a dark age seemed to be passing. For 12 centuries, a small flame of knowledge had been kept smoldering in the monasteries. Only now were their minds ready to be kindled. Long ago, during the last age of reason, certain proud thinkers had claimed that valid knowledge was indestructible, that ideas were deathless and truth immortal. But that was true only in the subtlest sense, the abbot thought, and not superficially true at all. There was objective meaning in the world, to be sure, the non-moral logos or design of the Creator, but such meanings were God's and not man's, until they found an imperfect incarnation, a dark reflection within the mind and speech and culture of a given human society, which might ascribe values to the meanings so that they became valid in a human sense within the culture. For man was a culture-bearer as well as a soul-bearer, but his cultures were not immortal, and they could die with a race or an age, and then human reflections of meaning and human portrayals of truth receded, and truth and meaning resided unseen only in the objective logos of nature and the ineffable logos of God. Truth could be crucified, but soon, perhaps, a resurrection. The memorabilia was full of ancient words, ancient formulae, ancient reflections of meaning, detached from minds that had died long ago, when a different sort of society had passed into oblivion, there was little of it that could still be understood. Certain papers seemed as meaningless as a breviary would seem to a shaman of the nomad tribes. Others retained a certain ornamental beauty or an orderliness that hinted of meaning, as a rosary might suggest a necklace to a nomad. The earliest brothers of the Leibowitzian order had tried to press a sort of Veronica's veil to the face of a crucified civilization. It had come away marked with an image of the face of ancient grandeur, but the image was faintly printed, incomplete, and hard to understand. The monks had preserved the image, and now it still survived for the world to inspect and try to interpret if the world wanted to do so. The memorabilia could not, of itself, generate a revival of ancient science or high civilization, however, for cultures were begotten by the tribes of man, not by musty tomes. But the books could help, Dom Paolo hoped. The books could point out directions and offer hints to a newly evolving science. It had happened once before, so the venerable Bodilus had asserted in his De Vestigiis Antecessorum Civitatum. And this time, thought Dom Paolo, we'll keep them reminded of who kept the spark burning while the world slept. He paused to look back. For a moment he had imagined that he had heard a frightened bleat from the poet's goat. The clamor from the basement soon blanketed his hearing as he descended the underground stairs toward the source of the turmoil. Someone was hammering steel pins into stone. Sweat mingled with the odor of old books. A feverish bustle of unscholarly activity filled the library. Novices hurried past with tools. Novices stood in groups and studied floor plans. Novices shifted desks and tables and heaved a makeshift machinery, rocking it into place. Confusion by lamplight. Brother Armbruster, the librarian and director of the memorabilia, stood watching it from a remote alcove in the shelves, his arms tightly folded and his face grim. Dom Paolo avoided his accusing gaze. Brother Kornhoer approached his ruler with a lingering grin of enthusiasm. "Well, Father Abbot, we'll soon have a light such as no man alive has ever seen." "This is not without a certain vanity, brother," Paolo replied. "Vanity, Domine, to put to good use what we've learned?" "I had in mind our haste to put it to use in time to impress a certain visiting scholar. But never mind. Let's see this engineer's wizardry." They walked toward the makeshift machine. It reminded the abbot of nothing useful, unless one considered engines for torturing prisoners useful. An axle, serving as the shaft, was connected by pulleys and belts to a waist-high turnstile. Four wagon wheels were mounted on the axle a few inches apart. Their thick iron tires were scored with grooves, and the grooves supported countless birds' nests of copper wire, drawn from coinage at the local smithy in Sanley Poets. The wheels were apparently free to spin in midair, Dom Paolo noticed, for their tires touched no surface. However, stationary blocks of iron faced the tires, like brakes, without quite touching them. The blocks, too, had been wound with innumerable turns of wire. Field's coils, as Kornhoer called them. Dom Paolo solemnly shook his head. "It'll be the greatest physical improvement at the Abbey since we got the printing press 100 years ago, Kornhoer ventured proudly. "Will it work?" Dom Paolo wondered. "I'll stake a month's extra chores on it, my lord." "You're staking more than that," thought the priest, but suppressed utterance. "Where does the light come out?" he asked, peering at the odd contraption again. The monk laughed. "Oh, we have a special lamp for that. What you see here is only the dynamo. It produces the electrical essence which the lamp will burn." Ruefully, Dom Paolo contemplated the amount of space the dynamo was occupying. "This essence," he murmured, "can't it be extracted from mutton fat, perhaps?" "No, no, the electrical essence is, well... Do you want me to explain?" "Better not. Natural science is not my bent. I'll leave it to you younger heads." He stepped back quickly to avoid being brained by a timber carried past by a pair of hurrying carpenters. "Tell me," he said, "if by studying writings from the Leibowitzian age you can learn how to construct this thing, why do you suppose none of our predecessors saw fit to construct it?" The monk was silent for a moment. "It's not easy to explain," he said at last. Actually, in the writings that survive, there's no direct information about the construction of a dynamo. Rather, you might say that the information is implicit in a whole collection of fragmentary writings. Partially implicit, and it has to be got out by deduction. But to get it, you also need some theories to work from. Theoretical information our predecessors didn't have. But we do? Well, yes, now that there have been a few men like... His tone became deeply respectful, and he paused before pronouncing the name. Like Thon Tadio. Was that a complete sentence? The abbot asked rather sourly. Well, until recently, few philosophers have concerned themselves with new theories in physics. Actually, it was the work of Thon Tadio, the respectful tone again, Don Paolo noted, that gave us the necessary working axioms. His work on the mobility of electrical essences, for example, and his conservation theorem. He should be pleased, then, to see his work applied. But where is the lamp itself, may I ask? I hope it's no larger than the dynamo. This is it, Domne, said the monk, picking up a small object from the table. It seemed to be only a bracket for holding a pair of black rods, and a thumb screw for adjusting their spacing. These are carbons, Kornhauer explained. The ancients would have called it an arc lamp. There was another kind, but we don't have the materials to make it. Amazing. Where does the light come from? Here. The monk pointed to the gap between the carbons. It must be a very tiny flame, said the abbot. Oh, but bright, brighter, I expect, than 100 candles. No. You find that impressive? I find it preposterous. Noticing Brother Kornhauer's sudden hurt expression, the abbot hastily added, To think how we've been limping along on beeswax and mutton fat. I have been wondering, the monk shyly confided, if the ancients used them on their altars instead of candles. No, said the abbot, definitely no. I can tell you that. Please dismiss that idea as quickly as possible, and don't even think of it again. Yes, Father Abbot. Now, where are you going to hang that thing? Well, Brother Kornhauer paused to stare speculatively around the gloomy basement. I hadn't given it any thought. I suppose it should go over the desk where Thon Tadio... Why does he pause like that whenever he says it? Dom Paolo wondered irritably. We'll be working. We'd better ask Brother Armbruster about that, the abbot decided, and then noticing the monk's sudden discomfort. What's the matter? Have you and Brother Armbruster been... Kornhauer's face twisted apologetically. Really, Father Abbot, I haven't lost my temper with him even once. Oh, we've had words, but... He shrugged. He doesn't want anything moved. He keeps mumbling about witchcraft and the like. It's not easy to reason with him. His eyes are half blind now from reading by dim light, and yet he says it's devil's work we're up to. I don't know what to say. Don Paolo frowned slightly as they crossed the room toward the alcove, where Brother Armbruster still stood, glowering upon the proceedings.
"Well, you've got your way now," the librarian said to Kornhauer as they approached. "When'll you be putting in a mechanical librarian, brother?"
"We find hints, brother, that once there were such things," the inventor growled. "In descriptions of the Machina Analytica, you'll find references to..."
"Enough, enough,"
the abbot interposed. Then to the librarian, "Thon Tadio will need a place to work. What do you suggest?" Armbruster jerked one thumb toward the natural science alcove.
"Let him read at the lectern in there like anyone else."
"What about setting up a study for him here on the open floor, Father Abbot?" Kornhauer suggested in hasty counterproposal. "Besides a desk, he'll need an abacus, a wall slate, and a drawing board. We could partition it off with temporary screens."
"I thought he was going to need our Leibowitzian references and earliest writings," the librarian said suspiciously.
"He will."
"Then he'll have to walk back and forth a lot if you put him in the middle. The rare volumes are chained, and the chains won't reach that far."
"That's no problem," said the inventor. "Take off the chains. They look silly anyway. The schismatic cults have all died out or become regional. Nobody's heard of the Pancratian military order in 100 years.
Armbruster reddened angrily.
"Oh, no, you don't," he snapped. "The chains stay on."
"But why?"
"It's not the book burners now. It's the villagers we have to worry about. The chains stay on."
Kornhauer turned to the abbot and spread his hands. "See, my lord?"
"He's right," said Dom Paolo. "There's too much agitation in the village. The town council expropriated our school, don't forget. Now they've got a village library, and they want us to fill its shelves, preferably with rare volumes, of course. Not only that, we had trouble with thieves last year. Brother Armbruster's right. The rare volumes stay chained."
"All right," Kornhauer sighed. "So he'll have to work in the alcove. Now, where do we hang your wondrous lamp?"
The monks glanced toward the cubicle. It was one of 14 identical stalls, sectioned according to subject matter, which faced the central floor. Each alcove had its archway, and from an iron hook embedded in the keystone of each arch hung a heavy crucifix.
"Well, if he's going to work in the alcove," said Kornhauer, "we'll just have to take the crucifix down and hang it there temporarily. There's no other—"
"Heathen!" hissed the librarian. "Pagan! Desecrator!"
Armbruster raised trembling hands heavenward.
"God help me, lest I tear him apart with these hands! Where will he stop? Take him away! Away!"
He turned his back on them, his hands still trembling aloft. Dom Paolo himself had winced slightly at the inventor's suggestion, but now he frowned sharply at the back of Brother Armbruster's habit. He had never expected him to feign a meekness that was alien to Armbruster's nature, but the aged monk's querulous disposition had grown definitely worse.
"Brother Armbruster, turn around, please."
The librarian turned.
"Now drop your hands and speak more calmly when you—"
"But, Father Abbot, you heard what he—"
"Brother Armbruster, you will please get the shelf ladder and remove that crucifix."
The color left the librarian's face. He stared speechless at Dom Paolo.
"This is not a church," said the abbot. "The placement of images is optional. For the present, you will please take down the crucifix. It's the only suitable place for the lamp. It seems later we may change it. Now I realize this whole thing has disturbed your library, and perhaps your digestion, but we hope it's in the interests of progress. If it isn't, then—"
"You'd make our Lord move over to make room for progress?"
"Brother Armbruster,
why don't you just hang the witchlight around his neck?"
The abbot's face went frigid.
"I do not force your obedience, brother. See me in my study after Compline."
The librarian wilted.
"I'll get the ladder, Father Abbot," he whispered, and shuffled unsteadily away.
Dom Paolo glanced up at the Christ of the Rood in the archway.
"Do you mind?"
he wondered. There was a knot in his stomach. He knew the knot would exact its price of him later. He left the basement before anyone could notice his discomfort. It was not good to let the community see how such trivial unpleasantness could overcome him these days. The installation was completed the following day, but Dom Paolo remained in his study during the test. Twice he had been forced to warn Brother Armbruster privately, and then to rebuke him publicly during chapter. And yet he felt more sympathy for the librarian's stand than he did for Kornhauer's. He sat slumped at his desk and waited for the news from the basement, feeling small concern for the test's success or failure. He kept one hand tucked into the front of his habit. He patted his stomach as though trying to calm a hysterical child. Internal cramping again. It seemed to come whenever unpleasantness threatened, and sometimes went away again when unpleasantness exploded into the open, where he could wrestle with it. But now it was not going away. He was being warned, and he knew it. Whether the warning came from an angel, from a demon, or from his own conscience, it told him to beware of himself and of some reality not yet faced. What now, he wondered, permitting himself a silent belch and a silent beg pardon toward the statue of St. Leibowitz in the shrine-like niche in the corner of his study. A fly was crawling along St. Leibowitz's nose. The eyes of the saint seemed to be looking cross-eyed at the fly, urging the abbot to brush it away. The abbot had grown fond of the 26th-century wood carving. Its face wore a curious smile of a sort that made it rather unusual as a sacramental image. The smile was turned down at one corner. The eyebrows were pulled low in a faintly dubious frown, although there were laugh wrinkles at the corners of the eyes. Because of the hangman's rope over one shoulder, the saint's expression often seemed puzzling. Possibly it resulted from slight irregularities in the grain of the wood, such irregularities dictating to the carver's hand, as that hand sought to bring out finer details than were possible with such wood. Don Paolo was not certain whether the image had been growth-sculptured as a living tree before carving or not. Sometimes the patient master carvers of that period had begun with an oak or cedar sapling, and, by spending tedious years at pruning, barking, twisting, and tying living branches into desired positions, had tormented the growing wood into a striking dryad shape, arms folded or raised aloft, before cutting the mature tree for curing and carving. The resulting statue was unusually resistant to splitting or breaking, since most of the lines of the work followed the natural grain. Don Paolo often marveled that the wooden Leibowitz had also proved resistant to several centuries of his predecessors, marveled because of the saint's most peculiar smile. "That little grin will ruin you some day," he warned the image. "Surely the saints must laugh in heaven. The psalmist says that God himself shall chortle, but Abbot Malmedy must have disapproved, God rest his soul, that solemn ass. How did you get by him, I wonder? You're not sanctimonious enough for some. That smile, who do I know that grins that way? I like it, but some day another grim dog will sit in this chair. Cave canem. He'll replace you with a plaster, Leibowitz, long-suffering, one who doesn't look cross-eyed at flies. Then you'll be eaten by termites down in the storage room. To survive the church's slow sifting of the arts, you have to have a surface that can please a righteous simpleton. And yet you need a depth beneath that surface to please a discerning sage. The sifting is slow, but it gets a turn of the sifter handle now and then, when some new prelate inspects his episcopal chambers and mutters, 'Some of this garbage has got to go.'" The sifter was usually full of dulcet pap. When the old pap was ground out, fresh pap was added. But what was not ground out was gold, and it lasted. If a church endured 5 centuries of priestly bad taste, occasional good taste had, by then, usually stripped away most of the transient tripe, had made it a place of majesty that overawed the would-be prettifiers. The abbot fanned himself with a fan of buzzard feathers, but the breeze was not cooling. The air from the window was like an oven's breath off the scorched desert, adding to the discomfort caused him by whatever devil or ruthless angel was fiddling around with his belly. It was the kind of heat that hints of lurking danger from sun-crazed rattlers and brooding thunderstorms over the mountains, or rabid dogs and tempers made vicious by the scorch. It made the cramping worse.
"Please,"
he murmured aloud to the saint, meaning a nonverbal prayer for cooler weather, sharper wits, and more insight into his vague sense of something wrong.
"Maybe it's the cheese that does it," he thought. "Gummy stuff this season, and green. I could dispense myself and take a more digestible diet. But no, there we go again. Face it, Paolo, it's not the food for the belly that does it. It's the food for the brain. Something up there is not digesting. But what?"
The wooden saint gave him no ready answer. Pap, sifting out chaff. Sometimes his mind worked in snatches. It was better to let it work that way when the cramps came and the world weighed heavily upon him. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.